No, that was your wishbone.
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 It's the Wishbone Podcast with Dave and JD.
That is one big pile of shit.
Pants got tighter. So when you happen to deal with shit, listen to some shit.
That is one big pile of shit.
But every single thing would suggest that Hulk Hogan is just a giant piece of shit.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It is Dave here coming to you on what should be the 8th episode of the Wishbone Podcast. I am here, however, to give some bad news, maybe disappointing news, maybe some sad news, or maybe this is good news because you've been following along and it's kind of like torture for you. But we do not have an official episode for you this week. We are taking what could probably be best described as either maybe a sick day or a sick week, really, right? Due to some circumstances, which I will get into. To give you some context, I think we've talked about this a bit before in previous episodes, but typically what we do is, as you know, the podcast gets posted 6 a.m. every Monday morning. And so that means we record the episode at some point during the previous week. Now, the original plan when we first started this was that we would be recording the podcast typically on a night when Josh didn't have to work the next morning. Okay. And what we run into, though, after the first few weeks is Dart League started. So now there's Wednesday night Dart League. There's Thursday night Dart League. Well, that creates an issue, right? So what we had been doing after that is we'll typically record on a Saturday night or, worst case scenario, on a Sunday, which leaves very precious little time for me to edit to get ready for Monday morning drop, right? Well, the problem is, this weekend, Saturday morning, I woke up and was sick. So I came down with something. My kiddo had been sick the previous week. I think it finally caught up to me. I'm sure the heavy drinking on Thursday and Friday didn't help, but either way, here we are. And so I did not feel up to working with JD on putting together an entire hour-long podcast and then doing the work, you know, to get that ready and get that out to you guys. And so my apologies, this one falls on me. But what I didn't want to have happen is that we just didn't post anything out there. And so, you know, I know we've got several followers, listeners, subscribers, people who I think enjoy the podcast. And so wanted to throw something, at least a little bit together, to give you some context. And in doing so, I wanted to give a couple of specific people a shout out here. Now, again, I know we've got multiple followers, listeners, subscribers. We appreciate all of you. We love all of you. But wanted to give a special shout out to our friend John, who's been sharing our podcast with his friends, his family on social media, encouraging them to listen to it. John, we love you. We appreciate you. Thank you so much for doing that. And also wanted to give a shout out to our buddy Jesse. It's funny, he was actually messaging me last week. It's one of the sub on a darts. Unfortunately, you know, JD and I have darts on Thursday, so we couldn't do it. But also, you know, you made sure to mention in there how much you enjoy the podcast. And so we greatly appreciate it. You know, anything we can do to try to bring some laughs, you know, we really do this because we think it's fun and funny. Although, you know, JD, you know, bringing some of those darker stories about, you know, people hitting their kids with their cars and, you know, putting their babies in the oven. Yeah, I think we struggle to come up with some jokes sometimes about those things. But we're glad to hear that you guys enjoy it. And we certainly have no plans to slow down. We will be back at it this week. I'm finally feeling a little bit better as I record this. It's a little bit after 8 o'clock on a Sunday night. But we got a lot of fun stuff planned for the official 8th episode. More gay animals. There's some weed stuff we're going to talk about. There's some Vince McMahon stuff that I want to talk about. And so just a lot of really fun stuff. We got a great Crushmore that's going to be coming up this next week. Top 4 people that are alive that we'd want to have dinner with. So looking forward to hearing the answers on that and just getting back into the swing of things. And so with that, again, didn't want to leave you guys with absolutely nothing this week to listen to. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to wrap this up, and then I'm going to gift you guys with chapter one from the book Adrift in the Unknown, or Queer Adventures in a Queer Realm, which was written by William Wallace Cook. And the description, it goes on to say, a delightful, imaginative, and sometimes silly adventure in early science fiction. Join a noble scientist and some of his less noble associates as they take flight in a newly constructed, seemingly magical spaceship. After they land on the planet Mercury, they are caught in the crossfire in a war between futuristic Mercurian city-states which wield high-tech weaponry. As they fight for their own survival and that of their fellow humans, each man is challenged to confront his own moral failings. Set aside your 21st century knowledge of physics and settle in for a lighthearted, somewhat predictable romp through outer space. So again, this is Adrift in the Unknown, or Queer Adventures in a Queer Realm, written by William Wallace Cook in 1905, as read by Amanda Rumbaugh. Chapter 1. Enjoy.
Chapter 1 of Adrift in the Unknown, or Queer Adventures in a Queer Realm. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Amanda Rumbaugh. Adrift in the Unknown by William Wallace Cook. Lost, strayed, or stolen. There could be no more fitting introduction to this most amazing narrative from the pen of James Peter Munn than that article in the Morning Mercury. Munn, it is no breach of confidence to inform the reader, was a reformed burglar. Although the author of two books which received large sales and were most favorably received by the reviewers, 40 Ways of Cracking Safes and The Sandbagger's Manual, Mr. Munn developed small skill with the pen, so that the breathless interest aroused by his revelations hangs more upon the matter than the style. The Mercury article should do its might toward preparing the reader for what is to come. In the first place, the story was what the newspapermen call a scoop. The article in the first edition ran as follows. Quinn's castle vanishes, and so does Quinn, with house and belongings. The Harlem sage disappears in a single hour, leaving not a trace behind. What happened to Professor Quinn last night? And what happened to the strange steel structure known locally among Harlem residents as Quinn's Castle? For Quinn and his castle were snuffed out like a candle gleam sometime between the hours of 11 o'clock and midnight. Patrolman Casey, who travels a beat in that part of Harlem, avers that he passed the castle at 11 o'clock, and that it was there. He passed its site again at 12, and it was not there. Considerably exercised, Patrolman Casey made search for the castle, and although he beat up the country for a dozen blocks in all directions, he failed to find it. And what is more, Patrolman Casey declares that he took the pledge when he went on the force, and has been a total abstainer ever since. Corroboration of the officer's report is not lacking. Certain residents of the vicinity state that they saw the professor's weird dwelling yesterday evening. Its windows were aglow, and it appeared evident that the professor was entertaining friends. The first gray dawn this morning showed a bare lot, with the steel house missing. Is it another case of Aladdin's palace dissolving into thin air at the presto of some wonder worker? Or is it a plain case of larceny undertaken on a gigantic scale? A golden opportunity offers itself to a sleuth of the Sherlock Holmes school, and for such a person the Mercury presents the following facts. First, the so-called castle was projectile-shaped, of boilerplate construction, and measured some 20 feet in diameter, tapering to a point 30 feet above the ground. It was covered with a sort of paint that gave it the appearance of frosted silver. Second, there is much low shrubbery surrounding the site of the castle, and if the castle had been blown down and rolled from the ridge it stood on into the river, there would have been left evidence in plenty of such disaster. Note, the castle certainly weighed 5 tons, possibly 5 times that. Nothing short of a cyclone could have budged it, and there was hardly a breath of air stirring the whole night long. Third, Professor Quinn, ever since he erected his steel house and moved into it, has been regarded as mildly insane. Like Abu Ben Adam, he desired to be entered on the angelic scroll as one who loved his fellow men. Last summer, he read before the Astronomical Society a paper entitled The Mutability of Newtonian Law, and he was laughed out of that honorable body for his inconsistencies. Although adverted to as the Harlem Sage, Professor Quinn is no Merlin, nor does he possess the Ring of Gyges that rendered its wearer invisible. Yet, where is he? And where is his castle? Until some Viduk appears and solves the mystery, Echo can only answer where. So much for the article in the first printing of the paper. The bright young man who stood sponsor for the scoop had meanwhile been very busy with fresh details, and the second edition contained the following addenda. It has just been learned that Mr. Emmett Gilhooly, the multimillionaire and president of the railroad combine, was a guest of Professor Quinn last night, and must have been in the castle at the very moment it faded into oblivion. Mr. Gilhooly did not return to his home, and has not since been heard from. His relatives are distracted, and leading railroad men of the country are in a panic. His absence from affairs at the present moment jeopardizes the traction interests of the entire country and may prove a death blow to the success of the gigantic pool he was forming. This was startling news indeed, and sped hither and yon throughout the city, the country, and the civilized world. Appalling as the information was, nevertheless, it proved merely a fractional part of the truth. The bright reporter on the Mercury made further discoveries, which were printed in the third edition, rushed from the presses of his paper. Not only was Mr. Emmett Gilhooly a guest of Professor Quinn in the Steel Castle last night, but so also were Honorable Augustus Popham, the Coal Baron, J. Archibald Meigs of Wall Street, late manipulator of the corner in wheat and now engineering a corner in cotton, and Hannibal Markham, well known as the instigator of a plot to control the food supply of the United States. What has become of these four millionaires and Napoleons of finance? They have gone with Quinn and his castle, disappearing as utterly as though the earth had opened and swallowed them. Fabulous rewards were offered by the relatives of the missing millionaires for any information relative to the fate that had overtaken them. Foul play was suspected, and the financial world stood aghast and dumbly wondered what was to happen to the business of the country if it really developed, beyond all peradventure, that Gilhooly, Popham, Meigs, and Markham had been eliminated from commercial affairs. The influence of these four was vast and far-reaching, and they were scheming to make their grip on the Republic's resources even more secure and relentless. If their plans carried, no man could eat, or clothe himself, or warm his body and drive his manufacturing engines, or travel from place to place and ship the product of his mills without paying tribute to Gilhooly, Popham, Meigs, and Markham. Should those schemes, titanic in conception, be worked out to their manifest conclusion, four men would hold the destiny of industrial America in the hollow of their hands. Prosperity would wait upon their pleasure, or at a mere nod would be paralyzed and leave the country stranded on the reefs of disaster. It seemed an odd fatality that, at the very time these commanders-in-chief of industry were plotting to make their power complete, they should have vanished as utterly as though they had been engulfed by a tidal wave and swept into the broad regions of the Atlantic. A few facts were brought to light through the probing of skilled detective minds, but these facts were in no wise clues to the fate that had overtaken the millionaires. Popham's confidential aide reluctantly admitted that his chief had accepted an invitation from Quinn and had gone to his castle for an interview. Quinn professed to have made some discovery or other which, he declared, would make coal a useless commodity so far as human needs were concerned. Popham, while laughing at Quinn's pretensions, was nevertheless secretly worried. Anything that threatened the success of the coup, which was being engineered by himself and his three confreres, was to be dealt with decisively and without loss of time. In the case of Meigs, Markham, and Gilhooly, there was no confidential aid to offer testimony, for these bright, particular stars of high finance had placed a limit on the confidence reposed in their secretaries. Nevertheless, the probing minds at work on the case developed the extraordinary fact that these men, no less than Popham, had visited Quinn at the latter's request. A spirit of scoffing investigation animated them, but they were prepared to see with their own eyes and hear with their own ears whatever Quinn had to show and to say. If anything that militated against their projected coup was brought before them, they would proceed to lay the specter forthwith. Strangely enough, the shrewdest of the detectives failed to connect the disappearance of the millionaires with the comprehensive plans they were forming, and which could not be carried out except by the plotters in person. Other rich men of the country, who were wont to trim their sails in accordance with whatever wind blew from the offices of the Four in Wall Street, were already shifting affairs to lay a course that would give them the best headway against the projected new order. This sudden disappearance of the powers to which the lesser rich looked for guidance left them becalmed in an uncharted sea. The middle class, long accustomed to being mulcted right and left, accepted the astonishing situation with equanimity. So far as they were concerned, Gilhooly, Popham, Meigs, and Markham were abstract generalities, merely names to conjure with. For years, the middle class had paid for the conjuring and had been taught to look calmly into the eyes of what they had come to believe was the inevitable. If their annual outing to the seashore or the mountains cost too much, they could stay at home. If the butcher, the baker, and the grocer ran prices too high, some of the luxuries could be cut out. If anthracite went to $20 a ton, they would heat fewer rooms, and if clothing became too expensive, there would be fewer suits and gowns to wear. By a little self-denial, the middle class could also trim their sails to any gale that blew. They were used to it. With the poor, it was different. They were already down to bedrock in the way of self-denial. No sooner had it drifted through their brains that the influence of Gilhooly, Popham, Meigs, and Markham had been blotted out than they lifted their voices in praise of the blessed event. Their situation had been bad enough, and any change, among the vaguely understood causes presiding over their affairs, could hardly be for the worse. The detectives, feeling that they were at work on a particularly complex case, hampered themselves by looking for complex causes. At first, they believed it was a matter of sequestration, and that presently a ransom in 7 or 8 figures would be called for. However, a delving into Quinn's past failed to reveal any lawless actions that would point to a ransom in his present line of endeavor. The detectives, growing more complex as the ambiguities closed them in, overlooked entirely the simplicity of Quinn's character. Anyhow, one analytical mind would demand of another, what had Quinn's intentions to do with the disappearance? That was a positive reality. And although it was surmised, it was not definitely known that Quinn himself had had anything to do with it. Such was the situation confronting the country and with which the police department of New York City was called upon to deal. But the keenest reasoning, inductive or deductive, was powerless to find even a clue. The tremendous mystery might have remained a mystery until this day, had it not been for the narrative of James Peter Munn, now, for the first time, given to the world. End of chapter 1.